Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Governor Matt Mead is wrapping up his final weeks, and he'll discuss some topics, including his biggest disappointment.
Providing better health care, not only cost-wise, but access to health care.
Farmers have been turning to Twitter to have conversations about mental health and depression.
We are social creatures. When you live in a rural area, you're surrounded by fewer people.
State lawmakers are looking at ways to reduce the prison population, and if they don't, it'll be costly.
We're going to be increasing our prison population by another 200 beds by 2023. That comes with a cost, about $50 million.
We'll have those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming Governor Matt Mead is wrapping up his time in office. I had a chance to talk to the governor during an event this week, and here's that interview.
Is this sentimental right now as you head into the final weeks?
It is a little bit sentimental. You know, it's amazingly busy. We thought we'd be slowing down a little bit, but it's been busy, and when you're busy, you don't reflect as much. But yeah, there's a great honor and privilege to serve as governor for 8 years in Wyoming, and we're going to miss certainly some of the job, but we also, 8 years in politics is a good amount of time, and we're looking forward to getting back to the ranch life and spending more time with the family, and so it's good. I mean, we're just in a very good place, and looking forward to the next administration taking over, and they're going to do a great job.
You must be a little jealous. Governor Friedenthal came in, and we had gobs of money. You got to come in, and it kind of went the other direction a little bit. How tough has this been?
It is tough. I mean, summer 16, beginning the fiscal year 17, as you know, we cut about $250 million. I cut about $250 million out of the budget. And just the process of going through was difficult, but much more difficult was recognizing those dollars represent services to Wyoming people. They represent what the states and the partnership the state has with the county government and local government. And it has a real impact. And so it was difficult to do, but you know, we can't outspend ourselves, and we had to respond to the revenue at the time. And as you know now, we're in a much better place. Our rainy day funds, we predict, is going to be at an all-time high, or our permanent funds going to be at an all-time high. Our budget right now that I presented is less than it was 8 years ago. So we've been fiscally conservative and responded to it. But you know, I used to hear the first couple of years some legislators say, you know, is it harder being a legislator when you have money or don't have money? Because when you have money, everybody, you know, wants it. Let me tell you, it's easier having money than not having money. I think that debate is over in my mind.
Do you think that the state's in position now to sustain the cuts and maybe just kind of stay here and move forward?
I think so. I mean, as I, you know, you heard me present my budget today, and we're leaving at the legislator's discretion about $300 million on the table. And so they will be able to, you know, make some decisions. But I think, you know, oil has been, you know, spotty up and down, up and down. Gas prices are low, but production's been pretty good. And, you know, spot prices are looking better on natural gas. So I think we're in a pretty good place, at least for a while. And partly I believe production is going to remain robust. And that's because the oil and gas companies that come in and talk to me, they talk about the investment they are making and are going to make in Wyoming in the next year. And that, you know, those are long-term plans. They don't plan it month by month. Those are long-term plans. So I think we're going to continue to have robust production for, you know, a couple of years, and hopefully prices will continue to help.
Are we ready for like a big boomish kind of thing to happen where we are ready for our environmental situation? Are we set up for that? Because there have been times in the past where we got caught off guard.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because just a case study, you know, in North Dakota, you know, they got hit with such a big boom, and even talked to the governor and lieutenant governor there. You know, the revenue and the money was great, but some of their small towns sort of got overrun with, you know, they didn't have the roads to maintain it. They were a little behind on their environmental. Mm-hmm. We went through that with the coal bed methane a little bit. You remember the water issues and, you know, what are we going to do with the water? All of a sudden it was an issue. I think we are better prepared for that type of thing now. I think we've made some advancements in oil and gas with setbacks, with baseline water testing. And I think we are in a place where we remember that we love the robust economic activity, but you have to do it the right way because we love our communities. We love so much Wyoming means to us in terms of clean air, clean water, and open spaces. And so we definitely want to make sure we're doing the right way. And I think we're better prepared than we were in the past to do that.
One of the things that you came on board with about midway through was Medicaid expansion. I think you were leery about it initially.
Yeah.
And then came on board. What kind of changed your thinking there?
Well, we were actually, you know, when I was campaigning, I thought that the ACA, which in part required people to buy insurance, was not legally, wouldn't stand legal muster. So we were one of the states that joined in the lawsuit, and we lost the lawsuit. And so for me, it's the law of the land, and they had initially a 94% 6% match, and then it would go down to 10% state money, 90% federal money. And it looked like to me that that was a way to help provide insurance for more people in the state of Wyoming. We have roughly 20,000 people that are uninsured. I'm concerned about those 20,000, but the 20,000 also affect all of us, because if they go to an emergency room for primary care and can't pay for it, the hospital can only take so much free care or charity care, and then they have to raise what the price of what they're doing, which is in response to the previous question, it ups the healthcare costs for all of us. So if those people would have had insurance, those 20,000 people, and were utilizing it, while I didn't like the ACA and I thought it was legally insufficient, it turned out to be the law of the land, and so it looked like to me it was the best deal for Wyoming to move forward with Medicaid expansion. The money that would come into the state, you know, was hundreds of millions of dollars for health care for our citizens. I think it would have addressed the 20,000, roughly 20,000. And I think it would have prevented, hopefully, the rising health care costs, because those people, rather than raising the rates for all of us because they're not paying for it, and then the hospitals and providers have to make up for it for the payers, those who do have insurance, that it would have been helpful. Healthcare is just has been very tough in Wyoming, and it's an area where I, as I list things that I'm disappointed in, it's an area where I'm afraid we didn't move the needle as we needed to in providing better healthcare, not only cost-wise but access to healthcare. So I'm hoping that as we've improved connectivity across the state of Wyoming, that we will be able to do more with telehealth and telemedicine and find some cost savings in there.
You were talking about your disappointment. That's one of them. Are there other disappointments where you go, gosh darn it, I really thought we'd get this through in 8 years?
I think the healthcare one is really, I mean, this is a challenge for Wyoming. We're trying to, you know, stimulate our economy and diversify our economy, but if you don't have adequate healthcare, it's really going to be hard to do. So I think that would certainly be one. I think one of the ones that I have been working on, which is energy corridors for CO2 pipelines to pre-permit those with BLM. I thought we were going to have it done by the end of this year, and I got the word BLM is going to wait until next year, which is okay, but I wanted to keep the pressure on them. And then the Endangered Species Act, and we've done a lot of work on the Endangered Species Act through Western Governors to try to reform that. And I'm not disappointed in it. It's Senator Brassel has been working on it. It's in Congress, and hopefully that can get done. I was hopeful that I would still be in office so that I could assist with that to get it across the finish line.
That was Wyoming Governor Matt Mead. When we come back, we'll hear what state corrections officials have to say about some proposals intended to reduce Wyoming's prison population. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming's Joint Revenue Committee will not change how ad valorem taxes are collected just yet. The one-time mineral property tax has left counties over $50 million in the hole as of July due to systematic issues like an 18-month wait for tax collection and prioritizing banks. An agreeable solution is still out of reach, with the legislature cycling through the same options year after year. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports that cycle continues into 2019.
Members of the Joint Revenue Committee sit around a raised crescent-shaped table, hearing testimony about a draft bill, one that would accelerate its collection to every month rather than every 18. Larry Wolf, a former lawyer dealing with industry at Holland & Hart, calls that 18-month schedule a historical artifact.
And it has always, always disadvantaged the state of Wyoming, the school districts, the counties.
Given that ad valorem taxes help fund county services and education, another advocate for change explains the 18-month collection rather than monthly leaves counties vulnerable to companies that abandon the area without paying their taxes. Naturally, not everyone felt similarly to Wolf. The Department of Revenue said a transition could cost $5 to $6 million. Oil, gas, mining, and business advocacy groups all argued the move would be unfair to extractive companies, the ones providing the most taxes to the state. Wyoming Mining Association's Travis Detai.
To change the system because of a minor percentage of delinquent filings, it's punitive, and it's unfair to the scores of operators that comply and pay on time.
Considering the billions in assessed ad valorem taxes, groups argue delinquency is only a tiny percentage and that companies would have to hire new employees to handle a transition. Even one of the committee members, Gillette Senator Jeff Wasserberger, gave an impassioned speech arguing the accelerated collection schedule would cost thousands of jobs. Eventually, the chairman and retiring Buffalo representative, Mike Madden, called everyone to order.
Is everybody ready to vote? Question's been called.
Senator Ellis.
No.
Senator Kinski.
No.
Senator Wasserberger.
No.
And.
Okay, that motion or that bill was defeated.
The vote was 4-9 against the change. But the meeting didn't feel quite over. Throughout the testimony, this other idea kept popping up, one that industry, legislators, and environmentalists all seemed to agree on: the concept of putting county governments first in debt collection. They call it giving counties lien superiority. Right now, counties could end up behind several bona fide creditors, receiving cents on the dollar of what's owed. Fixing that could solve the problem. Here's Travis Detai again.
And Mr. Chairman, we would support lien superiority.
Hesed Brandau with Powder River Basin Resource Council agrees.
You know, lien superiority does look like the next best solution.
Chairman Mike Madden, who's been the force behind solving ad valorem tax delinquency.
This is really something that's laying there for us, and it's something that would not harm coal companies that are in existence.
But lien superiority is far from a new idea. It failed in the legislature just last year, and the idea of monthly collection was introduced and withdrawn the year before. It's all part of this same ongoing cycle. In 2017, the lien superiority bill failed due to pressure from the Wyoming Bankers Association. Its director, Mike Giese, says nothing's changed, and he plans to make the same arguments if it comes up again.
What's going to happen is some small producer is going to come in and want to buy some equipment or something and borrow the money to do it, and the bank's going to have to say, hey, guess what? It's now a riskier loan. I'm going to either have to charge you more or I can't do it. So that's the reason why it's in the place of the way it is.
Giese says monthly collection is the only way to fix it. The Petroleum Association of Wyoming also opposed lien superiority in 2017. Its president says that likely won't change either if a bill came up. While either side bats options back and forth each year, counties like Sublette in western Wyoming are actively struggling with millions in unpaid ad valorem taxes. Roxana Jensen is the treasurer there. She had to visit Houston due to a lawsuit with Vanguard Natural Resources. The company only paid half its taxes before going bankrupt. Jensen says she's not sure if monthly collection would help her anyway, but she says lien superiority absolutely would. She remembers a bank foreclosed on a company 5 or 6 years ago, and the county never saw a dime of what was owed.
And when the bank foreclosed on them, that totally shut off my taxes because I was not in the first position.
A bill on lien superiority could appear this legislature, though no instructions were given to the Legislative Service Office. It could also become an interim topic next year. But for now, Chairman Madden says the cycle continues.
We kind of go around in circles, and certainly it could be like a volleyball type thing, I guess.
Madden says he hopes everyone remembers their commitment next time around. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Wyoming's prisons are overcrowded, and the problem is predicted to get much worse. The Wyoming Department of Corrections was forced to place 88 prisoners out of state this year, and so the state brought in the Council of State Governments Justice Reinvestment Program to try and find some solutions. As we've previously reported, the reason behind the growth is that too many people are being returned to prison on probation and parole violations. A legislative committee adopted some legislation that could address this issue. Bob Lampert is the director of the Wyoming Department of Corrections, and Steve Lindley is his deputy director. They both join me to discuss the issue, and Mr. Lindley describes the problem.
One of the large drivers of prison population are failing probationers and parolees. So nearly half of the annual intakes to prison, which are roughly 500 individuals, are there as a result of failing some condition of their probation and parole or parole, largely without a new criminal conviction. And of course, substance abuse and mental health issues play a large part of that. What much of this legislation was looking at are ways to intercede there to see if some percentage of those individuals can be diverted in different ways that, of course, don't jeopardize public safety and maybe improve the likelihood of their success. So that's probably, I think, maybe the single largest focus.
Were there things that, I guess, probation and parole officers could do differently as opposed to legislation that, that might address this problem too?
We currently have in place what we refer to as PRISM. It's a sanctions and rewards system that provides our agents with different tools to encourage positive behavior while they're on probation or parole, but also sanction negative behaviors in ways that don't necessarily lead immediately to a revocation of their supervision and placement in prison. So a lot of the, I guess, the core tools that are also incorporated in the draft legislation are in place, but there's limitations on that, and particularly around the probation side of the house, which is controlled by the courts, to give the agents a little bit more discretion in how to manage those alternative sanctions, including placement in jail for 2 to 3 days over a weekend, for example, for violations of conditions of parole or probation, particularly related to substance abuse, as well as intermediate sanctions of a longer period and placement for up to 90 days for additional treatment and attention to their criminogenic needs prior to return to probation or parole. So the draft legislation expands some of those alternatives.
So my big takeaway this whole summer and even previous to that is the lack of available mental health services or treatment facilities that we have in the state seem to be centered in certain locations and not statewide. And so if you're a judge, and use the judge in Pinedale who brought this up as an example, you know, really there's nowhere in his community can he place somebody. Are you satisfied that maybe legislators are getting that message and we might start addressing that?
Well, certainly that's something that will be continue to be reviewed by the legislature as well as Department of Health and regional mental health centers as well as ourselves. This particular pieces of legislation don't directly address any gaps that exist. And the biggest gap is in terms of residential placements across the state. There are substance abuse and mental health providers in all of the counties, but they have there's a little bit of gap in getting offenders that are releasing from prison immediately to those centers, and having follow-up treatment in a timely fashion. So that's gaps that we will continue to pay attention to.
What we'll be doing as an adjunct to these other pieces of legislation is working with the Department of Health and the mental health directors and the sheriffs and chiefs and the other stakeholders across the state to see if we can determine some of the hurdles to getting access to mental health care and substance abuse treatment. Because what has also come out of the Council of State Governments data review is that nearly half of the individuals we have that have an access need, an assessed need for substance abuse principally, are not accessing the system. So we need to spend a lot of time figuring out how to what that looks like and why that group is not able to get into the system or hasn't so far anyway.
You've tried this before. How do you finally get this stuff passed?
I think it's just a matter of continued education. This time we've done a better job of taking the act on the road, so to speak, and having more engagement at community levels, engaging various groups like the sheriffs and chiefs and the prosecutors associations. But ultimately, it's a matter of letting the public know that if we don't do something different, we're going to be increasing our prison population by another 200 beds by 2023. That comes with a cost, about $50 million in potential increased construction and operations and confinement costs. So instead, we're suggesting now's the time to look at alternatives that can shift some of those resources or defer those resources so they don't have to be spent for prison beds, and some of them can instead be spent on closing the gaps around substance abuse treatment issues, for example, or mental health issues, and taking lower risk individuals who may be better served in the community, taking those individuals out of the, the prison express lane.
Bob Lampert, Steve Lindley, always great visiting with you, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Bob. Have a good week.
Later in the program, another reporter who's covered this issue went to North Dakota to see how they addressed this problem, and we'll hear from him. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Sportsmen and women have to be really careful to make sure that they're not trespassing on public land. A new report finds that Wyoming has the most landlocked public land in the West at 3.05 million acres. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska locks in on a decision by Park County commissioners that could have added another 160 acres.
Down the South Fork, outside of Cody, there is a parcel of state trust land. In order to access this land, one has to drive down Road 6JM. But as Jim Gleason found out, it's a little confusing.
And drove out, and then I, just thought, well, because of these signs, I don't want to get tagged for trespassing or create any problems.
Gleason is a Cody resident and an avid hunter and angler for years. He depends on public lands to recreate. Road 6JM has an easement which allows the public to access 160 acres of state trust land that otherwise would be landlocked by private land. County engineer Brian Edwards says those trespass signs are left over from when there was no easement on the road.
There was never physical legal access prior to 1992, which is when the landowners granted those easements to the county.
In 1992, landowners surrounding the state land granted the county easements to a couple of roads for the purpose of making a loop road. One of those roads was 6JM, the road that Gleason was trying to access. The loop road was never built, and now TE Ranch, which owns the surrounding land, petitioned the county to vacate Road 6JM and the other road because the county is not maintaining it. Edwards says it's too expensive to maintain the roads for a handful of people, which means the public would lose access.
It should revert back to that original condition if the county is not pursuing a loop road.
Gleason says there needs to be access to public land. Joel Webster agrees. He's with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, which recently published a report finding a total of 9.52 million acres of landlocked federal public lands in the West.
Traditionally, things such as county abandonment of maintained roads probably wasn't perceived as a big issue because the public felt like they could use those routes. But now we live in a time where access to private land can be pretty challenging to acquire.
Webster says the West and Wyoming has so much inaccessible public land because of the way the West was settled.
The federal government incentivized the establishment of railroads to the West by passing various railroad acts, whereby they would give those railroads alternating sections on both sides of the track. It would look, you know, just like a checkerboard where the railroad would get black squares while the federal government would retain the red squares.
Checkerboarding is when land ownership is intermingled between federal and private land, which makes it difficult to access some public land. According to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife survey, 72% of Western hunters depend on public land for some or all of their access. So for hunters in the West, like Brian Webster, this matters.
The lack of access is one of the top reasons cited for giving up our sporting traditions.
Webster is the Colorado and Wyoming chapter coordinator for the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers Group. He says access to public land has become a major issue for their group. They are trying to work together with the state, federal, and local landowners to open and keep public access. Jim Gleason, the Cody resident who brought this to the group's attention, agrees.
What I would like to see is a cooperative agreement with the state and the TE Ranch to perhaps open access to that BLM ground that's landlocked behind their land.
For now, the public easement on Road 6JM survived another day as the Park County commissioners decided to contribute some money to work on the road, which means access to the public land still exists. But this is a short-term solution, and the bigger issue of guaranteeing public access to public lands continues. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
The last few years have brought revelation after revelation about just how long and complex the migration routes are for Wyoming's elk, pronghorn, and mule deer. Everyone involved in wildlife agrees that these routes need special protections, but there hasn't been a comprehensive set of maps showing their routes zigzagging all over the state. Until now. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards sat down with Matt Kaufman and Emmeline Oslin, two of the editors of Wild Migrations, Atlas of Wyoming's Ungulates.
Migrations really lend themselves to storytelling because they're journeys. And as we've gotten better and better data from the research that's been happening around migrations, those stories have really come to life. We know so many details about these animals' movements. I think of it as sort of a golden era of migration research that's been happening that is followed by a golden era of storytelling around migrations, and that has reached people's imaginations as we can picture these animals moving across the extraordinary landscapes of Wyoming.
You know, the bird migrations, they just sort of like, you know, it's spring or early summer, and all of a sudden they just show up, and you don't really know where they came from, and then they disappear again. But these animals are basically moving across the same landscapes where we live and work. And in some cases, you know, when we look at the migration corridors, like we've been to those same places. I think we make some of the same movements, right? We live in the valleys, and then when we go to hunt or go for a backpacking trip or a camping trip, we make those same movements up into the mountains. So I think they're familiar to us.
I wonder if you guys can each talk about what your favorite map or set of maps might be in the book.
I really love the maps on the snowpack. They show the amount of snow on the landscape and four different ungulate species migrations. And it shows that the pronghorn migrate first in October when the first snow hits because they don't tolerate very much snow. And they make a pretty long migration down to an area that's going to be relatively snow-free through the winter. And then the mule deer are the next to migrate. followed by the elk a couple of weeks later, and the moose is the last to migrate and makes a pretty short migration and tolerates pretty deep snow through the winter. I mean, it has beautiful colors and depictions and everything, but also I think tells an interesting story and really taught me something about how these animals respond to their environment that I didn't quite have pieced together in my head before working on that page.
Yeah, I think for me, one of the maps that really stands out is the map of Interstate 80. In making that map, we literally, like, we started with the interstate, and then we said, okay, you know, which animals sort of come into this band that cuts through southern Wyoming? And this sort of this picture just kind of emerged. And the picture that emerges is how much a barrier Interstate 80 is, because you see, you see mule deer coming from 150 miles away down to their winter ranges near the town of Superior and literally, you know, sort of bumping up against Interstate 80, and you see other individuals that live a life, you know, on the southern side of Interstate 80 and just never cross over to the other side. And so there's so much traffic on Interstate 80 that it really comes out as a barrier. And that was one where just adding the individual map routes to the map just sort of revealed that. And people look at the map and can easily see it. You don't really have to interpret it for them.
My favorite maps might be the ones about the early humans and how they interacted with these migrations. Can you talk a little bit about how early humans interacted with these migration routes?
We ended up dipping into archaeological information, rock art, findings of tools and bones of migrating ungulates that had been harvested by people on the landscape in the depths of history, and then leading up to journals from trappers and explorers describing the animals they saw on the landscape. And the history chapter of wild migrations also talks about the exploitation of migratory ungulates through market hunting, just the slaughter that occurred as Europeans moved into these landscapes and basically decimated a lot of these herds, bringing them almost to zero by the turn of the century.
And just talking about the making of these maps, what the process has been. You mentioned that it's been several years that it's taken to put this book together.
So we were really fortunate to be able to work with Jim and Alethea. They're at the University of Oregon in the Department of Geography, and they are sort of atlas design cartographers. You know, they make atlases for a living, and we would sort of present to them, you know, kind of like we would make our crude maps and say, see, you know, this shows, you know, X, Y, or Z. And they were kind of a good litmus test, because they'd sort of be like, we're not really getting that, you know, from those maps. They are extremely good at figuring out, okay, well, what is the story? Well, let's figure out the different layers on the map that we need to show that.
What's your hope? How is it going to further the conversation about how we should manage wildlife and these migration corridors?
Well, so far, no migration corridor in Wyoming is protected from end to end. And I feel like we're on the cusp of a big conservation breakthrough for migrations, but we don't yet know what that's going to look like. The conservation mechanisms maybe haven't been totally invented, or at least haven't been all pieced together yet. So it feels very important to have a communication tool to put these maps into people's hands so they can stare at them and think about them and dream up these solutions for the future.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with Matt Kaufman and Emmeline Osland, editors of the new book, Wild Migrations, Atlas of Wyoming's Ungulates.
Ranchers and farmers living in the Mountain West are vulnerable to all kinds of things: drought, fluctuating crop prices, trade wars, and in part because of those things, depression and suicide. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, there's some help out there from an unlikely source.
It's called Hashtag Ag Twitter. It started as a digital place where farmers and ranchers could get advice on the best fertilizer or farm equipment.
A lot of people follow them.
That's Caleb Carter. He works in the Department of Plant Sciences at the University of Wyoming, but essentially he's a traveling consultant for farmers and ranchers. Today, we're driving down dirt roads that run through corn and wheat fields. Carter says on any given day, farmers ask him for all sorts of advice.
You know, what's wrong with my tree? Or why is my tomato plant leaves curling? And,
but what they don't do, he says, is talk about themselves. Ag Twitter, though, is changing that, and Carter says farmers are sharing their own personal stories on the app, from worrying about how to put food on the table to reflecting back on a time when they wanted to give up. He says it's been a powerful experience to see all these conversations open up.
And if nothing else, it at least helps people realize, like, oh, wow, this person who looks like they've had it all together, you know, and is always on Twitter and is always sharing their stories and sharing all this stuff, like, they're struggling with this too.
And he says this digital space is perfect for farmers who are often isolated because of what they do.
Because of that isolation, it's really easy for that thought to really take over and for you to be like, oh man, all the other guys I talked to at the coffee shop, like everybody else, they're doing great. And I'm the one struggling here and not sure if I'm going to make this payment or not sure how I'm going to do this.
Wyoming has one of the highest rates of suicide in the country, and so do all the other states that are our neighbors. So we've always had the highest rates of suicide in this region going back 100 years.
Dr. Carolyn Pepper is a professor in the psychology department at the University of Wyoming. She studies suicide in the Mountain West and ticks off the many reasons why farmers in our region are susceptible to depression and suicide. First,
we are social creatures. When you live in a rural area, you're surrounded by fewer people.
Then, she says, there's the environmental stressors specific to the job.
If you are a farmer or a rancher and the weather is bad that year, that creates an economic burden on you.
And let's not forget the Westerner's cultural reputation.
They're willing to go out and live in a harsh environment and solve their own problems, but part of that comes with a belief that maybe you're better off if you don't show your emotions and you don't show your weaknesses.
So is tweeting for help the answer? It depends.
If we're using social media to separate from the people around us, that can have negative effects.
But she says it can be positive if farmers are using it to connect with people face-to-face, at least virtually. Stephen Schuler agrees. He's a professor in psychology at the University of California in Irvine. His work deals specifically with the relationship between mental health and social media. He says digital spaces have some advantages.
One way that they're different than spaces in real life is that it's less stigmatizing sometimes to be able to go on to an online space.
He says this can be especially true for rural areas where services are limited.
There is one, you know, mental health clinic. And so if people see you going there, they know what you're doing.
Schuler says generally social media users can be broken down into three groups. 1% of people are posting, about 9% are interacting, but the other 90% are just there watching. Still, Schuler says even if you're not tweeting or responding, the experience can still be powerful.
This kind of instance of this hashtag in these farmers that you're talking about, you know, it's powerful the people who are writing and the people who are responding, but it's also powerful for the other people who might be suffering through similar things who are not even, who are looking but not sort of, you know, engaging.
Schuler says it's an interesting moment for social media, but it's not always good.
Instagram actually has a lot of communities that are on there that are sort of pro anorexia, that are, you know, promoting the thin ideal and trying to help people figure out ways to diet and restrict and do all these, you know, negative, harmful things. I think there are some questions on whether or not, you know, content like that should be able to be sort of publicly available and posted on these platforms.
Of course, that gets at a persistent question at the moment. Just what responsibility do platforms like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram have in controlling their content? Schuler says a lot. But while that debate goes on, he hopes more positive hashtags like #AgTwitter continue to crop up. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, more on prison overcrowding, and we'll meet a hoop dancer. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. As we mentioned earlier in the program, Wyoming's prison overcrowding issue has been the focus of a study that aims to keep those who are on probation and parole from returning to prison. North Dakota has faced a similar problem, and WildFile reporter Andrew Graham reported on what they did. He speaks with Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson.
Andrew, you've been reporting on how Wyoming lawmakers are responding to the state's prison crisis. Can you kind of sum up what the problem is?
Yeah, so there's some outside researchers who have been looking at Wyoming's correction system right now, and they've come up with, 54% of our prison admissions are revocations on parole and probation, and 84% of those don't come from new felony convictions. So the vast majority of people aren't committing new crimes.
In trying to figure out what Wyoming could do to deal with that, you went to North Dakota. Why?
Well, North Dakota, like Wyoming, sort of suffers from this lack of mental health and substance abuse services, and it's a big rural state as well. But they've come up with a pretty creative solution that they put in place over the last couple of years to try and get a handle on this problem.
And one of the people who explained that to you was North Dakota's Director of Corrections and Rehabilitation, Leanne Bursch.
Right.
Let's hear a little bit of a conversation that you had with her.
But the frustration coming out of PMP was that if you want to keep people from being revoked or if you want to keep people from having an incarcerative sentence, then you have to have adequate resources in the community. And so that was very clear that we didn't have enough resources to really work with these high needs, high risk people in the community. And you know, at some point they got to the point where they really didn't have any alternative but to recommend treatment.
So she says P&P, what's that?
That's parole and probation. And that description of the problem in North Dakota is a lot like what lawmakers have been hearing here in Wyoming.
And so what has North Dakota done to deal with that need for more comprehensive treatment?
So North Dakota went through a very similar process that Wyoming's going through now, where they looked for kind of broad solutions to their prison growth. And they put in a lot of sort of sentencing reforms that would kind of have an immediate impact on lessening the number of people who were being incarcerated. And then they took money that they would have spent building new prisons. In their case, it was $7 million over a two-year period. And they allocated that money instead to this new program they created called Free Through Recovery, which essentially is trying to create sort of a grassroots recovery system in places where there aren't clinical services, traditional substance abuse treatment, and instead tap into these networks, whether they're sort of faith-based networks or just people who are recovering from addiction themselves, and connect those people with people leaving the prison system or being diverted into probation.
And so Free Through Recovery, you know, this grassroots effort, is that a permanent solution?
No, I think everyone I spoke to in North Dakota was quick to say this is not the final solution. But when you compare the costs to the costs of trying to get more clinical providers into some of these rural areas, it's sort of like it's taking advantage of what's already there to just try and get some kind of a handle on this problem, even if it's not permanent.
What's your sense of what stands in the way of Wyoming following the footsteps of North Dakota?
There are perhaps a couple challenges here. The biggest one so far is that while lawmakers are really taking a look at our incarceration rates and they're trying to figure out how to head them off, so far there's been like a recognition of the need for more services and more support for people going out on probation and parole, but there hasn't been sort of that clear dedication of funds. We're going to take $7 million and put it over here. We haven't seen that quite yet.
Is anybody talking about that?
I think people are talking about it, but it's not in the legislation that I've seen that's coming out of this broad criminal justice reform effort.
You can read more of Andrew Graham's reporting on what's happening in North Dakota and how it could help Wyoming online at wyofile.com. Andrew, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hoop dancer Jasmine Bell of the Crow Creek Dakota Tribe in South Dakota has danced all over the world, for Muhammad Ali, for presidential first ladies, even the actor Kevin Costner. Bell tells a story to her 14-year-old daughter.
I said, when you were first born, Kevin Costner kind of babysat you. Because he said, I'll hold her while you dance.
Belle is a two-time world champion hoop dancer, but even for her, life hasn't been easy. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke to Belle, where she performed at the third annual Conference on Violence Prevention and Response in Riverton.
I started jingle dress dancing when I was a young girl, about 3 or 4. And then my adopted father, my hunkwa father, he took me under his wing and we all started traveling and performing together. And when he first taught me how to hoop dance, before he even showed me anything, he took me outside to show me that sacred hoop and tell me the story of what the original meaning behind the hoop dance was. One thing that was really special about that is he shared with me that I was going to face a lot of hard times growing up in this male-dominated society because he knew that there was a balance missing in the circle.
And when you started to go out and compete, were there other girls starting to do the hoop dance?
When I first started hoop dancing, there was myself and one of my role models growing up, even to this day, Jackie Bird. She's from South Dakota. Across the country, there was maybe one or two here and there, but it was very scarce. There was very, very few. And then now in this day and age, we have, when you go, let's say, to the World Championship, you're looking at more than a third of female hoop dancers in the competition.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that traditional side and how that works for you in terms of your own healing and what the tradition is behind hoop dancing?
Okay, so there's many tribes throughout the United States and Canada that have hoop dancers. Each tribe has their story of how it originated, and they're different. For us, we have our own in the Black Hills, the Pahasapa. The main thing is, yes, it does represent the circle of life. And the traditional value behind it that I was taught from my father, from my grandfather, is that hoop dancing is a healing dance. When you go out there to dance, you're not dancing for yourself. It was never for a show. It was about going out there, telling your story through the creation of the designs that you make. And at the same time, when you're dancing, you're praying for those that are in need. I've seen where some hoop dancers have been in like Cirque du Soleil. For myself, they asked me one year if I would be interested, and yeah, it would have been a great opportunity traveling around to different countries, but I knew that what I represented, where my family came from, that was going to exploit the hoop dancing, and they were going to ask of me to wear paints and different things that I wasn't comfortable wearing, and so I unfortunately had to turn down that opportunity, but it was about keeping true to who I was.
And yeah, you mentioned that it has a lot to do with healing. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how this practice, how you've used it in your life for healing.
So growing up, I faced a lot of challenges. When I would go through bullying, and as I grew older, I went through domestic violence. I went through a lot of trauma from losing family members, and all of those, I guess, negative aspects in my life could have turned my spirit towards possibly even suicide, where we face that a lot in today's society. But because I had my hoop dancing and I was taught those values, when I would go out on stage and when I would dance, that was like a release of that negative energy. And when I was done hoop dancing, I felt better. Even then, it was part of the healing, but it wasn't the full healing process because it was like putting Band-Aids on my broken hoop. And it had to come to the point where I was comfortable and open with talking about it and sharing my story. Because the minute that I started being able to open up and share my story was when the audience that was watching me was able to connect, or I was able to help someone in the audience because maybe they were going through the same thing and they didn't realize that when I danced, I was dancing for them. So when they left, you know, there was a part of that healing, that prayer that went with them.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards speaking with renowned Native American hoop dancer Jasmine Bell.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. You can hear this show and past programs on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. There you can also find individual segments, and you can sign up for our podcast. And a reader is our web editor.
Thanks for your support of this program and all our Wyoming news coverage throughout the year. If you're making year-end donations, please keep us in mind. You can also make a pledge again at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.